You're listening to Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking with special guest Samantha Warren about the design deliverables that make sense for today's responsive web. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by Visual Chefs, a versatile web development agency with expertise in content management system and custom web application development. Through partnerships with designers, agencies, and organizations, Visual Chefs propels the web forward. Visit visualchefs.com to learn more. But before we get into the show, our major sponsor, Pixel & Tonic, has some exciting event news to share. The second annual Craft CMS Summit, which is a virtual one-day conference, will be live on April 22nd. Tickets and details can be found at craftcmssummit.com. And if you want to see the Craft team in person instead of your screen, the team is speaking in Philadelphia for peersconf.com between April 30th to May 2nd. Check out buildwithcraft.com/community to keep updated on what Pixel & Tonic and Craft are up to in the community and for more details on the events I just mentioned.
Today, we're talking about the design deliverables we're developing for our clients these days, including style tiles, which were created by our guest, Samantha Warren. Samantha is a designer and art director and works with a wide range of organizations from small startups to large tech companies to make their products and brands more awesome. Previously at Twitter, she specializes in a blend of visual design and user experience strategy. She also speaks at industry conferences like An Event Apart, spreading the word about style tiles every chance she can. Welcome to the show, Samantha.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
So, Samantha, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Yeah, I currently live in San Francisco with my amazing husband, who is a designer as well, and my cross-eyed cat. I've been recently getting into ceramics. I'm really bad at it, though, but I've been trying to learn how to do like pottery.
Ooh, very cool.
Yeah, and just designing. I work from home and I design for all sorts of awesome clients.
Very cool. I feel like a lot of digital designers these days are dipping their hand into, well, literally dipping their hand into physical objects. And in your case here, like creating ceramics or, you know, creating, you know, printed signs and paintings and things like that. Do you also find that true?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I had gone to school actually for art.
Oh.
And so, you know, over the past 12 years of being a designer, I have gotten farther and farther away from doing what I sort of originally set out to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked with a coworker at Twitter, Jen Cotton, and she's a ceramicist, and she manages to continue to be a very successful ceramicist on the side of also being a full-time designer. And so she sort of inspired me to try this. I'd never actually done ceramics before, so it was completely new. And it's just kind of it's about finding a new challenge for myself.
Oh,
but yeah,
cool.
I think it's great when people start to try and bridge that, because you can get very focused on pixels, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
It's got to free up a whole different part of your mind as well. You're still being creative, but you're using your body in a different way and you're using materials. It reminds me almost, Leia, of all of our developer guests who are into music.
Yeah,
playing
for sure.
Instruments, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Samantha, before we started recording, you actually mentioned that you literally got home from An Event Apart last night, and that what we are going to talk about today is something that was a bit of a running conversation while you were there. Can you tell me a little bit about how the Event Apart experience was and what some of the conversations about design deliverables were?
Yeah, I think it's a running theme right now, just in our industry. You know, how do we communicate with clients so that they understand the process of building a responsive website?
Mm-hmm.
And many of the speakers talked quite a bit about the types of deliverables that they use. Style tiles is one, but you know, Brad Frost talks a lot about atomic design. Kevin Hoffman talks a lot about what he does in order to communicate and have clear communication with the client. There's just a lot, I think, going on right now in this space because it's a new world of web design. You know, we're not just designing what was essentially kind of like 960 pixel wide mockups anymore.
Mm-hmm,
there's
right.
So much more to it.
Yeah. So in regards to that, things have gotten more and more complicated. But before we dive into all that complication, let's just start with the basics. What do you define as design deliverables?
I see a design deliverable as anything that you give a client within a pivot point in the process to communicate with them where you are. And so it could be a visual. It could also be documentation. It could be just a write-up and a summary of what it is that we had just discussed, but making sure that there's kind of an agreed upon statement at different parts, at different benchmarks within the process to make sure everybody's on the same page.
Mm-hmm. All right. So before today, like let's imagine 5 or 7 years ago, like what kind of deliverables were you providing clients? Like you mentioned, you know, like a 960 by something static comp. Like was it a series of comps? Was it limited to key pages? Were there other deliverables involved? Like you even mentioned a summary of a conversation or maybe a kickoff meeting, a summary of that. Or
the interesting thing is I think there's a lot of things that have changed, but there's a lot of things that have stayed the same. I think back to when I first started, the number of deliverables that I was producing was just unnecessary. Completely unnecessary. So, I mean, outside of what it was, but I remember I worked for a large advertising agency and I did something like probably 100 wireframes
for
for what would be, I would say, like a mid-size site. Not like a, it wasn't something that warranted 100 wireframes. But I remember there was just, you know, some strange place within the conversation that the account manager had had that I needed to provide all of these wireframes. And it was just so unnecessary. But that there was this expectation of receiving this giant stack of papers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, these were actually like printed out?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I worked in advertising, everything was printed out. I remember actually I stayed one night really late, and I was at this giant copy machine printer thing, just printing like all of these wireframes and thinking to myself, this is so wasteful. This is so unnecessary. But a lot of times, and I think back in the day especially, deliverables were seen as a way to make money. That's how you were making money.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you needed to have those deliverables in the contract and produced, even if they weren't necessarily efficient, because that's how the agency was making money. And that's how they were billing. And they had to have something in order to bill for. And people expect a thing, you know,
right,
versus having just like being a consultant and it just being time. So, but like looking back, you know, there was lots of wireframes, there's lots of mock-ups. But I think the things that really stand out in my mind is, you know, that idea of doing multiple very different mock-ups, having those choices. I think that in my mind is just incredibly wasteful. I can't stand inefficiency. And so those I felt like were really inefficient. But I think once we began to get to a place where it was very clear that the web was different and people were starting to experiment with what they gave their clients, I worked for an agency. We did mood boards. I actually did this thing we called a simple comp, which was actually just the header and whatever would be that, like the first half of above the fold of a first page. That was a deliverable I did for a few clients, but mostly mock-ups, mostly those static mock-ups and, you know, the homepage and key pages, but it's really changed and evolved throughout the years. And I think it still is, you know, it's very hard to say that there would be any one particular magic bullet for any one client as far as a design deliverable goes.
What tools were you using like to make those wireframes and to make those comps?
Interesting thing about that is I don't know if that would be something that's really changed a whole lot for me. Photoshop and Illustrator have been mainstays for me for a while.
Me too.
I still do wireframes in Illustrator, and I know that it may not be the most efficient way, but sometimes it is the fastest way for me to be able to express an idea.
Mm-hmm.
But so then I do remember that when you're doing 100 wireframes, Illustrator is not the best solution for that. And so I do remember doing those 100 wireframes in Illustrator. But I think the tools to some degree have stayed the same. There hasn't been a lot of change for me, at least there.
You know, Leah, I'm curious because this is something you bring up a lot when you blog for us, talking about why you continue to use Photoshop, even though you're aware of some of the newer choices out there today. I get the feeling that you feel similarly to Samantha. Photoshop is like, you're fast in it.
Yeah. I mean, since I started using Photoshop when I was 13 years old, it's one of those things where it's, I know it like the back of my hand. So even if there's faster or better tools, I would need to set aside time to understand them and learn them, which it might be an inevitability. But if we have a client that needs something and we're on a timeline, I'm going to open up Photoshop because it's what I know. And at the end of the day, you know, a visual is a visual is a visual, right?
Yeah, the client doesn't care what you're using ultimately.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's just a matter of figuring out which of these tools makes me translate what's in my brain properly and in a way that doesn't constrain my design thinking. Because I do feel like whenever we have these types of conversations, and I'm sure we're going to dive deep into this with Samantha too, like a lot of people are like, design in the browser, or design this or design that. But for me, I feel like it's so constraining that I'm thinking way too far ahead in the project, that my design thinking is concerned about whether it's going to render properly before whether this is the best solution or not.
Absolutely.
So, Samantha, you mentioned some of the deliverables that you've created in the past and that even the tools you used, they may not change that much, but the deliverables have to have changed to some degree. Like, I mean, you're not sending, you know, hundreds of wireframes these days, right?
Yeah, I think for me, it's more about setting the expectations up front. I feel like earlier in my career, I was further and further away from understanding the larger context of a design project. You know, when you first start out, you're just kind of like, hey, I'm a designer, give me work, I want to make things. And then you start to kind of put together, well, I could make things better if I had this situation in place. And then I kind of learned, you know, you start to work with other people. If you're on in an agency, you begin to work with your account managers and project managers and even the salespeople who sell the work to start to get a conversation going about how you create the environment and create the situation that would put you in a position and set you up for success in a project. And so as I've gained experience, I've recognized that there's a lot of inefficiencies. There's a lot of ways that you could, you know, we talked about the fact that they used to create deliverables a lot of times to make money. Well, what if I can save you money and still save you money and then leave you time to do something else in your project? So I've started to understand over a period of time how to kind of manipulate the budgets and the deliverables and all of that, almost getting into the business and the sales of design. And so that's really helped me to dictate what I find to set me up as a designer for success. And when I work really closely with others who are involved in the process, whether it's me just selling, I kind of can control the process and I work with my clients. But if I'm working in-house, communicating with my entire team, or if I'm working for an agency, communicating with those who are on that project with me.
So can you give me like an example of how you set those expectations with the client? I mean, obviously a lot of that is conversation and things like that, but what are the things you tell them to expect during, you know, the beginning, middle, and end phases of a project where design is involved?
So I usually start a project by doing a workshop of some sort or opening a conversation. I very rarely begin by dictating anything to a client because I find, and I set the expectation that the reason I'm doing this is for their benefit. You know, if I were to give them a cookie cutter solution before understanding their problem, I would be doing their problem a disservice. And so by setting that expectation of kind of having this conversation at the beginning, I'm able to get a good analysis of where we are from the client side of things, and from the project side of things. And then I try to put in place a framework. And that framework, I do that with the client. I work with them to kind of figure out, okay, these are the different phases that we need to go through in order to get the solutions that you're looking for. And again, it's about like almost hyper communication. I'm all about communicating very clearly with the client and making them my partner, really, because it's their website, it's their product that we're creating. And once I'm long gone from the process, if it's going to be successful, they need to be emotionally invested in it to make it successful. So by setting those expectations and helping them, like helping them to really set those expectations for themselves, it creates a setup that I feel like allows them to be armed for success. Mm-hmm. Creating that framework, and a lot of times there's different parts of that process and framework. It's like having a plan, really. And sometimes that plan is just verbally communicated and it's agreed upon. But again, depending sort of on the client and the situation, it may be part of the contract we sign. Mm-hmm. It may be very much something that's part of a statement of work. And I never try to be too prescriptive because, like, I mean, how many times do you start out doing one thing and it completely changes as you can continue to move through the process. So yeah, it's just, again, about communication.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like in many ways, when you're trying to set expectations, you kind of have to toe the line between being detailed about it as well as being vague. Mm-hmm. So it gives you enough wiggle room. Sometimes we mention we're going to show you some key pages. We're not going to show you every page, but we're not going to tell you exactly which key pages they are until you get them.
Yeah.
That everything sort of builds on each other. One of the things, as you were describing that, Samantha, it reminded me, we don't typically get too deep into what I call discovery or kickoff until after they've engaged with us. So we intentionally keep our statement of work vague rather than trying to like make it very specific before we really understand client deeply and their problem that we're trying to solve. And just recently we started doing after this sort of initial period of discovery where we're kind of learning a lot about the client and their site and their audience, we put together a really simple Google Doc that has everything from their key goals and priorities outlined to some of the highest level points about their brand and identity and the audience. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things that we're trying to do because we're trying to make sure that we always have a touch point for every decision we make that, you know, if at one point they come to us, like when we're already working on the comps phase and what they're asking for doesn't align with what they agreed to earlier, we have something to like bring them back to the discussion. This was the document that we agreed on. You know, are these still your goals? Like kind of reminding them what they said they wanted to start with.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And it's not a visual thing, so maybe someone might not perceive it as a design deliverable, but I feel like all of this stuff, like your communication with your client, that affects design. Like all of it is part of contributing to the ultimate design of the solution, both functionally and visually, or in other areas.
Yeah, I've done design principles actually as a deliverable, where we go through the process of kind of doing series of different workshop-y exercises. And then, hey, let's decide, what are the five goals? Like, how would you describe the principles for how this design should communicate? And we just kind of document them. It's kind of similar to what you're saying, but I like to call them principles just because it gets them sort of thinking. I want them to really feel like they are part of the design process. Mm-hmm. And the principles of design are now like their principles as a company.
Right.
Right. Well, because at the end of the day, the design is a translation of what they want their business to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
So once you have sort of that stuff defined, just assuming it's a somewhat linear process, do you then move into IA and wireframing, or is there something before then?
Again, it depends. It always depends. I sort of see my framework as being very chunked. So mm-hmm. I see every piece of the framework to be attached to a goal. And so particularly IA, I like to call it architecture because it's, you know, it's kind of like information architecture. It's the user experience. It's anything that's not attached to the visual brand. And so I see that as sort of having its own set of goals because mm-hmm. it's about very tactical, goal-driven user experience things that I don't want to get crossed with, I don't want them to see something and be like, oh, but I don't like that color green. And it's like, no, wait, the color green is not going to affect whether or not somebody gets the information they need in this situation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I sort of chunk that in its own little packaged process. And then I do brand and visual design in its own little package process. And so sometimes I've had many different scenarios here, but I do either those at the same time in parallel, and perhaps I'm the person doing both of those things, but I kind of keep them again as like separate deliverables and separate conversations. And then when they're both at a point where you've come to a consensus with the client, I then bring them back together. Mm-hmm. I've also done them linear. Like I've done maybe user experience first and then brand second, or I've done brand first and then user experience second. It depends on the stage that this client's at. For startups, for example, they may need a brand first because they may need to get funding and they may need a logo. If it's an established company, it may really be more important to get in there and just figure out how users get the information they need. So again, it depends, but I like keeping those things very separate because it keeps the client focused.
So when you do get to the wireframes phase, like if that project calls for it, what are you using to build your wireframes these days?
I usually use Illustrator. And again, it depends on the client. A lot of times I don't tend to do, you asked me about how my deliverables have changed. And now that I think about it, I don't do wireframes like I used to, like one wireframe per page. A lot of times I'll like create a giant artboard and kind of create like almost like a wireframe user flow sitemap. And I'll just say like infinity number of pixels and just get in there and make these giant kind of maps. And then, you know, I can like, if I need to deliver a specific wireframe at a time, I'll just zoom in and then save that out as its own little PDF. But
so this is just like a huge, big Illustrator file, all one thing.
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
And I've done that. I did that a lot when I was at Twitter, for example. And the reason that it worked really well in that scenario, I'm doing that actually for my current client that I'm working with. It works really well because then if I need to, I can go to a plotter and print out the whole map. And you can, and you know, I always hate saying print anytime I'm talking about interactive anything, but having that tangible thing in a meeting that you can just quickly point to and it's like there, you know, you might be showing something else on your screen. You might be showing, you know, maybe a part of the visual brand and you have that map there and you can kind of point to something and they are able to make that connection and kind of zoom in on the specifics while also understanding the big picture. I found that to be really helpful. So I do tend to do stuff like that a lot. So it's mostly an Illustrator, and it's mostly because, yeah, I'm very comfortable with Illustrator. I would love to perhaps use something like Balsamiq more often, but again, it depends on the client, and a lot of times, you know, the output that Illustrator gives me is what I need and what I can create the fastest in.
I'm curious about your Illustrator workflow then. Do you have like custom shapes and stuff like that saved?
So I hadn't for a long time. So I mentioned my husband is also a designer. He's a designer at a tech company here in town, and he uses Illustrator for everything. And so he's like master Illustrator person, and he recently kind of was like looking over my shoulder and was like, hey, do you know you could use symbols to do that faster? And it was really great because I had not used symbols before. So I've started recently using symbols. It was a really great tip he gave me. I guess it makes it a little bit more like a product like OmniGraffle where you can kind of reuse them. And it did really make my workflow faster. And I'm probably still a little bit awkward at it, but I would like to get faster at that.
Have you ever done anything with web-based wireframes that are responsive?
I have not, but what I have done, however, is I find in my process the most difficult thing to demonstrate is responsive at an early stage. Mm-hmm. You know, because I don't want to get into making mockups for mobile, mockups for iPad, mockups for the desktop. So what I have done in a few circumstances is, have you guys ever used Macaw?
I've downloaded it, but I haven't like actually used it.
I have found Macaw to be really helpful for this in particular. I can quickly maybe gray box something there, or I can, you know, even if I've done maybe a mockup at one breakpoint, I can kind of take my assets and throw it in there quickly. And the great thing about Macaw is you can set your breakpoints and toggle between them. And so without outputting anything, you can show what a design looks like at different breakpoints and tweak it at those various breakpoints. So even if it's not something I'm outputting as a final deliverable, if I need to demonstrate what works responsively, that's been a great way to do that. So you could essentially do like a wireframe in Macaw. There's actually a wireframe mode. I've never used it. But you could, instead of gray boxing, you could build out your site and then go to a wireframe mode and then show those different breakpoints.
I'm curious with these static resources. Clearly, you make PDFs and, you know, images to show. Frankly, what Emily and I do is we just attach them to Basecamp or we link them through Dropbox, which auto shows up already on Basecamp. Do you have a more sophisticated way to show these deliverables? Because I do believe that there are some services or whatever out there that shows client space for deliverables?
Yeah, so part of what I do working for myself is I try really hard to integrate into the system that of the client that I'm working with. So I try to make it as natural for them, for me to go to them and say, hey, I need you to download this thing. It may be more awkward. So for example, I have a client right now who's very comfortable with Google Drive. That's just the best way really to communicate with them. And so Google Drive has worked fantastic for that. I've also used, so when I was at Twitter, we used InVision a lot. That was really effective in many circumstances. And when you're working with particularly multiple design teams, InVision's a great way to also communicate between the design teams on the deliverables before you send them to a stakeholder. However, when I used to work at an agency before, several years ago, we had built not, I wouldn't say a sophisticated system. I think we kind of just built like some HTML files that we duplicated and used via Dropbox for style tiles in particular to send style tiles over to a client. So we could just send them a quick URL and you would click through and you'd get the tiles laid out in just HTML pages. And that was really effective for a lot of our clients. But it depends on the team and it depends on the folks that you're working with. I try really hard to get a sense for what they're comfortable with and what's going to be natural for them. And I don't always hit that out of the park the first time, but you know, sometimes it may be a keynote that I share screens with and deliver via like a Google Hangout where I'm sharing my screen. Yeah, it all kind of depends on the context.
Before we move on and talk about style tiles, because that was a big game changer for us, as well as I think a lot of people in our industry, I want to give a quick little shout out to Travis Gertz, who while at EngineWorks, he put together, this was a couple years ago, this thing called Live Wires, which are basically web-based wireframes. And we took them and over the course of, and it's really been probably 18 months kind of fine tuning it for how we work and modifying in a way so that the underlying HTML structure and even some of the CSS that's driving these really low fidelity web-based wireframes, we can then move into our production code that it's not just this isolated deliverable where we're actually doing double the front-end development work. But they've been great for us. I mean, you know, I don't know how, Leia, you can chime in after I'm done running my mouth. As a developer, I love this because it gives me the chance to give the client the responsive experience before we've done any hardcore design on Leia's end or I've done any hardcore development to sort of make sure they're comfortable with how the general shape of a given page resizes and how the layout adjusts and even simple things like when you click on this button, this is an interaction that's going to happen rather than trying to show it with static. And it's super simple to pick up. It's super simple to sort of customize to your own workflow. And for any of our listeners who are kind of struggling with trying to get like the responsive experience to the client a little sooner, I've found this is great. We still sketch. Sometimes we might, Leia might sketch, whoever's doing the sketching, because sometimes we go back and forth, we use what we prefer. I tend to hand sketch and send Leia scans, and Leia tends to sketch in like Photoshop or Illustrator and send me those files. But then once those sketches are done, we take it into LiveWires.
That sounds awesome. I need to check this out.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason why we chose LiveWire is because there's so many frameworks out there. We didn't want to deal with everybody else's like glut of code.
Yeah.
And with LiveWires, it was just super clean and like gray boxing. Like it was literally gray boxing on the screen and it was just very, very clean and clear. So it was easy for us to customize. So that was our priority. So that's We definitely highly recommend that. However, recently we found that just like with anything, there's certain things that we make assumptions for because we're in the industry, so we get it already. But sometimes certain clients do need more information.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've started thinking about doing kind of that hybrid static dynamic approach where we still would build the live wires and we'll have like a web-based deliverable, but then we'll take a screenshot and then annotate that screenshot to send them a static explanation in case the browser itself isn't self-explanatory. Just sometimes clients need you to circle a box,
yeah,
point to it, and then explain
what
that
it is.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, even when I see the live wires, like every part of that page makes sense to me. But that's because we built it, you know, and we know what those boxes are. And sometimes clients do need that extra explanation and not just the bullet point with the URL, because that's what we used to do. I think that was what we did when we first started doing the live wires. We did the live wires and then we just explained in text, you know, with the URL what it was. But then in the future, we're possibly going to try to do a hybrid where we're going to send them the URL, then screenshots with certain things that we think might need further explanation.
I think it points to Samantha's point from earlier where it really depends on the client. We have some clients who get stuff right away.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's not a lot of hand-holding. They're completely comfortable in dealing with the deliverables we provide. And it's maybe one person. And then we have clients where there's a committee of people and they're all at different points on the range of understanding things. And for those clients, we may have to do that sort of annotation, the extra support that they may or may not need.
I think the interesting thing about deliverables is that there is a bit of a gut feeling you get sometimes.
Right.
You know, it's, I would love to say, oh, there's a science and a formula and a cookie cutter approach, but to some degree it is sort of like you meet someone and you start talking to them and you start to hear how they articulate specific things about the web. And you can get a sense that I think this person will be able to understand what a style tile is without necessarily the full explanation behind it. Or I think this person will be able to understand responsive. But then, you know, sometimes you're wrong.
Yes, I know, I've been totally
wrong. Right. And you find out like halfway through.
Yeah. But then it's just about being flexible and like always kind of having this toolbox of like, okay, I'll try this next. You know, I'll try this method or that method, and being able to throw them in. That's interesting.
I think it's definitely important that we emphasize the flexibility, because I think with this mobile mindset and responsive web design and development, a lot of people are really eager to just jump into the browser or totally reject all static deliverables. But at least in real life, in our experience, we still need a mix. Like, we still need a mix in order to convey what we need to convey to clients.
And I think it's more than just conveying to clients, but how we communicate to each other.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
You show me something that I might have to build, like, you know, the designer-developer relationship. So, Samantha, I next want to talk about the other thing. You know, I mentioned how Livewire's changed a lot for us. The other thing that changed a whole lot for us was your style tiles. So can you tell our listeners, you know, what style tiles are and how you kind of envisioned them? It seems simple once it's out there, but no one thought to put it out there. So,
yeah. So I had mentioned earlier, I had been doing mood boards with an agency that I worked with quite a bit, but mood boards had some issues. The main issue was a lot of times the clients would have a difficult time connecting this sort of vague idea of these maybe collage-ish looking deliverables with what their website was going to be. Like, they just couldn't make the connection between, wait, how does this turn into a button, right? And then the other piece of it was mood boards in themselves, they're a very popular deliverable across many design disciplines. And what I would run into is a client who'd say, well, I already did a mood board with my branding agency. Why am I paying you to do that too? And so I felt like there needed to be a deliverable that was very specific to web design, that wasn't too prescriptive. It actually came out of an experience I had where I visited, my husband's cousin is an interior designer and architect, and she was having an open house at her studio. And when we walked in, I was just amazed by these crazy large blueprints that she had all around her studio. They're beautiful and they were intricate. And I was asking her about them and she was explaining, you know, that we really set the goals for a particular building, you know, in these blueprints, and we're working around the constraints and trying to figure out, you know, does this need to be accessible? What is the environment around this particular building? So all of those types of things were figured out in these blueprints. And then she had this separate room that was full of carpet samples and paint chips and fabric swatches. And in the middle of the room, there was a little island that had these trays on it. And she explained to me that when she gets the entire architecture approved with her client, she then presents them with these options that are, again, made within the constraints of what is practical for the solution that they're going after. But they have a choice because they need to live with this product.
Oh, I have seen something like this in other areas, like with fashion and party planning and things like that, where they sort of like pick what they like and create like a tray of all their favorite things.
Yes. So that's exactly, I mean, it's not anything mind-blowingly new. I was just like, oh my gosh, we need to do this for websites. And it needs to, you know, make sense. You know, like a carpet sample makes sense because you're feeling and looking at the actual a smaller piece of a larger element in the greater design. So why don't we take the smaller pieces, like the buttons, and maybe it's a search bar, maybe it, whatever it is that we know we're going to use, and present them earlier on so that when you're making a decision about something like color, where you may, there may be several shades of blue that could work in the situation, you know, instead of having to go through final mock-ups and make all of those changes, like, let's get that out of the way in its own process. So I began doing it with clients specifically. I'm trying to think, the first client I did it with, it was a very low budget. And that actually really helped me make my case to the agency I was working with that we should try something new because it was a client we really liked. We really wanted their business, but they had a ridiculously low budget that didn't account for making lots of mock-ups. We needed to get something pretty tangible to a developer early on. And the style towel, it worked, like kind of surprisingly to me. I was like, oh my gosh, this really worked. and I mean, like anything, lots and lots of iteration around how it worked and, you know, what's the magic amount of time you need to estimate for something like this, how many revisions work for what types of clients, that sort of thing has been something, you know, it again depends, but also I've refined over a period of time. But that's sort of where the style towel came from. And interestingly enough, the agency I worked with when we really began to cement this was called Phase Two, and they're very active in the Drupal community. And they're supportive of everyone in the company being giving back to the open source community. This is a very important part of their methodology and just the principles that they live by. And so I had a lot of opportunities there to give stuff back. So I was like, well, all of the developers that I work with, they give back code all the time. I want to give back a piece of my process. So that's when I sort of codified it, made it a website, and I did a presentation at South by Southwest. And I never expected the website to catch on like it did because it was really just for the presentation. And that's sort of how it came about.
And for us, almost everything we find that we like, we somehow evolve for our own process. And that's how Style Tiles kind of influenced our own deliverable that sort of falls in that abstracted but still giving you a feel of a visual experience kind of thing. People who have used it, who you run into at conferences, like, has there been like a unique evolution or application that someone's told you about of your style tiles?
I love seeing when people do this because that's the whole piece of open source that makes it so special, right? Like, you take something that somebody else has did and you build on it. So I think in general, moving to browser-based style tiles is really interesting to me. A lot of the stuff that the folks at Sparkbox, Ben Callahan, talks about, like what they've been doing with their style tiles, is very interesting to me. Dan Mall has the element collages, which is kind of a similar method to style tiles, but more specific to UI elements. And so, yeah, over the period of time, people are doing lots of really interesting things with it, and they're using them very differently. I know that I use them a lot to take a company's brand and figure out what that means for the web, or maybe it's a sub-brand, right? And like use it for exploration. But there's a lot of people who are using them as, Anna Debenham was just showing me a style tile one of her clients gave her, and she's a front-end developer. And, you know, it helped her to influence how she built the site. When everything isn't spelled out, it kind of helps someone fill in the glue in between pieces that aren't necessarily completely visualized. So there's lots of really interesting things that people are doing with them. And I think that's the best part of like the open source world, is just you don't have to use anything the way somebody has built it. You can take it and do whatever you want with it. And watching that grow and change has been really, really awesome.
So with Samantha's Style Tiles, I originally applied it essentially as a Photoshop template that she had on the website when I first started playing around with it. And that worked really well to help plan the rest of the design, because it really is the kernel of the idea of a design system. I think in the past, when we're thinking about like all the mock-ups we did, part of it was kind of like old design print thinking, where everything needs to be like a poster. And, you know, that's what you send. But then when you have deliverables like a style towel, you're starting to think about like the elements that will apply to all the pages and how will all these things work. Now, having the style towels just as a static deliverable, though, is a little bit limiting for us because we want the client to understand the context of their site in a browser as soon as possible, especially because anyone who knows Photoshop knows you have to make sure that the color space is correct, that you save it in the right, you know, RGB and all these kind of things. And there's so much monitor variations that what you save in an image might end up being different in a browser. So might as well just get that into the browser first and foremost. So for us, we thought it made sense to translate like a style tile as essentially the first step into our final design system in the browser. And it's one of those things that what we start there and what they accept there and they see it in the browser, then they see it in the context of their monitor. So there's no weird color shifting. The size of the font is actually the size as well as the aliasing, because that's something as a designer that like so frustrating, just the difference of anti-aliasing across systems and browsers. But if they see it in their browser, then they're like, what I see and what they see might be slightly different, but they see it in the actual context that they want to see it in. So if they don't like something, then it's fixed in that situation. And everything really starts off as that like little seed. And then we go into something that's kind of like Dan Moll's element collage, and we call it element collage, but it's still, it's not quite exactly the same thing still. And at that point, we start, once the client accepts what's happening in the in-browser style tile, we start making the modules of the site that we think will affect more of the overall design before we even get into the comp stage. And that's also kind of a hybrid of both static images as well as actual HTML and CSS. So generally speaking, if it's text related, we tend to show the actual HTML CSS already on the actual element collage deliverable. But if it needs to have more styling, quote unquote, around it, like a navigation bar or how we want to treat photographs or backgrounds and things like that, then I don't actually code that in HTML CSS. I just make a mockup in Photoshop, save it as a JPEG, and shove it into the HTML deliverable. And all of these, like, we try to put it in a browser context. So even if we do have like a JPEG of what the final HTML and CSS is going to be, it's still in that context where the client understands.
And I think another thing that we're doing, you know, we haven't yet had an opportunity to apply this, but we've sort of changed our underlying internal framework, is that where the element collage does include actual HTML and CSS, we have these little modules. Like, let's say for a button, there's a specific way I code a button. And so Leia just calls that include that has my HTML in it and that has my styles. And then she has a handful of styles where she changes color and font sizes and border radius and things like that. And then, you know, once it's approved, that CSS and that HTML carries over into the actual production. So we're trying to do more reuse of these things, so they're not just these independent things that aren't influencing the final work, but they're contributing to it. And not just design, but also, you know, in browser, the development of it.
Yeah, because I feel like in the old school way, we're always doing everything from scratch. And that really didn't make any sense when a button is a button is a button. Right? Even if the button style is going to change, a website's going to have a submit button somewhere, you know?
There's something I wanted to ask both of you. Samantha, for you to start, I'm just curious about this because I can design, but it's kind of like I'm not a designer. So you mentioned back in the day, you when you were doing like mock-ups, you would give them a couple different choices. What are you doing now? Are you presenting to them your best choice and then iterating off of that? Or do you still give multiple options?
For the style tiles, there are multiple options. And I tend to try and hone in on what I call like blanket attributes. So there's a certain point where you know that you're not going to do three absolutely crazy ideas. So for example, I had a client who overwhelmingly said, you know, it needed to be patriotic. It needed to feel like a traditional publication. I mean, at that point in time, you know that it's going to be three different versions of a red, white, and blue color scheme with perhaps three different versions of a slab serif or a serif font. And so I'm all about giving you three options within the constraints that you sort of started to set for yourself in refining what your blanket attributes are. And sometimes it isn't three. I have done two in some circumstances. And I guess you could potentially give more. But the idea is then after you get a consensus on a style tile that maybe you might iterate, and it could be iterating, combining things from two tiles. It could be continuously changing some of the attributes of one particular tile. I've had a circumstance where client loved one particular tile, but just didn't feel right about the color scheme. So I've just done the tile and then iterated on color schemes for them. And then at that point, I generally then present one mock-up of a key page that we would decide beforehand. You know, for example, if it is a publication website, usually that key page is something more akin to an article page. But I tend to kind of work from the inside out as far as what pages I present. I don't generally give a lot of options unless they really need it, but I always try and hone in on what it is that they're uncomfortable with and really only try and iterate and give multiple options around that rather than doing large mock-ups and giving multiple options there.
So I'm curious about these multiple options in terms of just running a business and keeping your time and making sure everything's on track. Do you limit the amount of choices in a statement of work? And if they do need more options, like more style tiles or more iterations in the color scheme, et cetera, do you set a limit or do you just charge hourly?
I usually give an estimate range. And the way I do that, I generally say, for example, for a typical client, maybe I'll say 2 to 3 style tiles. And I kind of developed this formula around, I'm obsessed with harvest. So, I mean, like, this is a formulaic approach that I take based on seeing the patterns that I myself as a designer have developed over a period of time. So I kind of know that if I want to make a style tile that really gets the level of detail that I feel comfortable with presenting, it's about 4 hours. And so using that as sort of a baseline for what, if I'm presenting 3 style tiles, I time box them to 4 hours. And if they only need 2 tiles, then maybe I add more detail to the 2 tiles. And then I usually give them a set number of iterations. So maybe I'll say 1 to 2 iterations. And if it tends, I really haven't gotten to a situation where they continue to iterate, but I would probably have a clause where I say, you know, after that, it's then hourly at this rate for as many iterations as you would want. I try to not get too prescriptive when it comes down to that. A lot of times, depending on the client that I'm working with and my level of comfort with them, you know, I may say, hey, we're still at a point where we're iterating. We're going to need to take time out of the number of deliverables in the next phase. Are you fine with that? It's just about being very direct and upfront with them about how long it takes you to do things and what the level of effort is. And I've been really lucky in this circumstance that most of my clients have been very agreeable with this methodology, knowing that I'm kind of saving them time and getting them what they need under budget. And I think that in particular, the fact that I can kind of translate these steps to a number of hours, and this is the rate at that number of hours, so this is exactly what you're getting for that, has been incredibly helpful for me. People don't necessarily understand the vague mushy-gushiness of what a design does all the time. What is the value in this? But if you can say, hey, X amount of hours equals X amount of dollars for you, and you will get something like this in that amount of time, it helps them to begin to understand when you go through that amount of time and they haven't reached a decision that they want, you know, okay, it's time and money to continue doing that.
I think that's a lesson we're still learning. I feel like this came up recently for us. It wasn't in the design process in terms of the client asking for more and more iterations, But it turned out this client was just someone who really needed a lot of communication, more so than we had really factored into the budget. And as the contract stood, there was no, it was a flat rate. That's all there was. There was no line item for this is the number of hours of phone calls you get. Anything beyond that will be at our hourly rate. We didn't have that in place. And 20 hours of phone calls later, we were like, oh my God, like what's happened? And part of it was our failure, my failure as the owner of the business to notice this sooner and bring it to the client's attention sooner to sort of have that conversation and say, you know, it looks like, you know, we're communicating more and we want to provide that for you, but it does affect the timeline and it does affect our ability to begin actual production work. And we ultimately did have this conversation with the client. I just feel it was not too late to do anything about it, but it was later than it should have been. We should have brought it to the attention of the client a lot sooner. And as it turned out, she was very amenable to working with us and, you know, establishing a limit for communications and phone calls and then going hourly after that limit from this point forward in the project. But it's one of those things that I was so stressed the whole day just because it felt like such a hard conversation to have with a client to say, we're going to have to do something different than what we originally agreed upon and finding the right language. So, you know, because I was afraid the client would walk away. You know, you just never know. It's the hard conversations. And I think it would come up almost any time creep enters into a project. But I think you are completely right in what you said about you just are direct and you're respectful and you tell them what X amount equals in terms of time and resources so they get a sense of what they're getting for their money.
I've been really lucky in the fact that up until now I've worked with teams, either at an agency or in-house, that have the infrastructure to kind of educate me and help me learn all of those things. Since going out on my own, I've only been out on my own for about 6 months, but if you guys are familiar with Mike Montero and his My Lawyer Gabe, there's a lot to be learned from Gabe, I think. And I've reached out to him and gotten a lot of helpful tips on how to structure contracts and stuff. That in itself has been a really interesting process, but surrounding yourself with people who can help you and actually asking friends. I mean, I've called up a lot of friends who have been in the business working for themselves longer than me and been just like, hey, what do you do in this situation?
You're absolutely right. Aaron Gustafson, we've been working with him on a project recently, and he has been so wonderful for that. Every time I have a question, I just send it to Aaron, and I'm like, what have you done in this situation? How would you recommend I handle it? And, you know, he's got a lot more experience than I do working as an agency and having complex clients with big committees and lots of departments and things like that. So you're absolutely right. Asking people who know more than you is always a good thing.
But there's never like a right answer. That's a difficult thing because up until now, like in terms of communication, most of our clients have been within the scope that Emily and I would be comfortable with in terms of communicating and things like that. And I think part of the uncomfortableness is that I'm willing to talk to the client. It's like, there's no problem with having to, you know, I don't have a problem with having to explain myself and having a longer conversation. The problem is that time costs money.
Yeah.
You know, the longer that these conversations happen and the more frequently that these conversations happen, that's less time for us to design, that's less time for us to code. And then suddenly we still have to do all of that and we still have that timeline to keep up with. So it's definitely one of those things where I can talk all day about design. I can have a giant, you know, conversation over like every single reason why I chose that font and that size there.
Totally.
And some clients want those conversations, but are they necessarily a good business sense for either the client or yourself?
Yeah.
Not necessarily, but I definitely think the earlier you have that conversation to set those expectations, mm-hmm. you know, the better.
Samantha, I'm curious, are there any deliverables that whether you working by yourself, obviously with a client or with an agency, but, you know, within your own company versus, you know, like when you've been in an agency, are there any deliverables that is internal only that you're not really given to the client, but you're creating them for your own purposes, whether it's to share with someone else or to have a single place to go to each time for yourself?
Yeah, I think there's quite a few times where I do a lot of exploration as far as style or even like I think mobile, for example, I may not necessarily show them all of the mock-ups for a particularly like complex navigation. So for example, I was working on a navigation that had several layers of sub-levels. And, you know, when that broke down to mobile, it got really complex. And I needed to work that out for myself on many levels, from an information architectural level, but also from a visual design level, because that really affected how usable it was at that level. And at a certain point, you know, it was just going to probably confuse or create more conversation that needed to be created. It didn't need an approval process. So I wouldn't probably show them that unless it was directly asked for.
Right.
But anything that helps me to understand a complex problem and doesn't necessarily need to be approved, that's where I usually keep that internal. I do a lot of exploration on my own, though, of just like, I do a lot of almost like mood boardy type work that I probably would never show a client. But just to get a good sense, I have I love to feel the brand. I know that sounds strange, but I have this like kind of emotional connection that I have to make with any brand where I like really feel like I know what it is. And sometimes it takes a lot of visual exploration for myself, whether it's just collecting things, having like an inspiration box or maybe a Pinterest board. So I do a lot of that. And that doesn't necessarily need to be something that a client approves of either, I think.
I think for us, some of the things that come to mind internally, like I have to mention this, Leia, because it like blew my mind when you gave it to me last week. This is the first time in my 20 plus year career as a front end developer that a designer has given me a document with all of the color and typography rules already broken out. Most of the time they send me a comp, I have to go into the comp and start extracting, you know, values. You know, what are the pixel values? What are the RGBs? All that other stuff on my own, which, you know, adds time, but that's how it's always been. I've asked for it and I've never gotten it. I've just get the comps. But Leia gave me this great document. Not only did it have like, you know, I had all the typography rules that she had built into her comps, but then also the information of, but in mobile, it's going to be this size. And then, oh, but in the footer, it's going to be this size, you know, little things like that. And the RGB colors as well, instead of just hex values. And we won't give that to the client, but that's a deliverable to me, the developer. And it probably saved me like a good hour and a half getting my basic SaaS stuff built with these, you know, the fundamental stuff that I normally have to go into the comp. And she uses Photoshop and I use Fireworks. And so I've always, you know, there's always a little bit of nuance involved in when you're working between different softwares and how they open up the files and stuff. So, you know, that's another good example of a deliverable that you could, that would just be internal, but it's great to help, you know, transition that design to the front end developer who's got to build it out.
Yeah, I remember when we first started Emily and I first did our first responsive design client. And you talked about how, oh, I'm just going to show them maybe like one mobile view and then one key page or whatever. We didn't do that. We created all these comps for this particular client. And then once we sent it to them, within 5 minutes, they accepted it. And while that sounds like a dream, for a designer, you're like, let's just accept it, you know, whatever, because then you can move forward with your project. But at the same time, you're like, why did I spend all that time? They just glanced at it and said, okay. And I really feel like that was kind of that turning point between me and Emily, saying like, we could have saved a lot of time. You know, could we have communicated the same thing to them with less views?
Or also, like, lately, Leia's been doing, you know, the smallest view, the largest view, and we generally give that to the client as comps. And then she does like an idea for some of the squishy middle, but that's just for us. You know, I see what I can implement in the browser. So the client doesn't have a set expectation for the middle. We sort of have a guideline that Leia's informed to me, and then as I'm developing and what makes sense and what feels right. So there is some design in the browser that happens there. And so that's like another thing that Leia builds, but we never even give it to the client. So before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you a few questions. What should you never, ever deliver to a client?
I think you should never, ever deliver to a client something that you are not confident in. There used to be this old practice of giving them a mock-up to kind of throw them off, right? Like something really bad, throw something bad in. I think that is horrible, there's a good chance they're going to go with that. So I think whatever it is, you should be incredibly confident and also passionate about what you're presenting to them. Don't give them anything that you think is the wrong solution or that you're not passionate about being the right solution.
And what do you think we designers and developers can do now to sort of not only improve our client deliverables, but help communicate the value of these deliverables to clients?
I think the more we share amongst each other what works. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think every time we share, right, is when it kind of is like, oh, that's a game changer. Like when Ethan Marcotte came out with responsive design, you know, it's like, oh. And so every time we find something that really ends up working and sharing it, because I'm not necessarily convinced that we have all the answers out there right now, right? Like there's probably somebody out there like just killing it, doing something that just, maybe they haven't shared it yet. So I think just sharing everything that you do that works and in what scenario it is. And it's just kind of over communication, really. I wish I blogged more, but I think I haven't blogged in a long time. I need to do that. But anytime we all blog and kind of share this stuff, I think it benefits our clients, right? Because it's out there and they then see these things and it becomes a socialized concept. Mm-hmm. Like responsive design, you know, kind of could have existed before it was called responsive design by him putting a name to it. It allowed us all to have this like one definition, right, that we could all latch mm-hmm. on to and then move forward with sort of selling it collectively. And mm-hmm. when we do that, and I think, you know, to some degree, I try to do that with Style Tiles. I, in a million years, never expected clients to come to me asking for that. But now they're asking for it. And so I don't have to do like this large portion of education that I used to do. And so every time I'm not educating a client on a deliverable, I'm then taking that same amount of time within their budget to do something super awesome for them at the end. Like maybe I'm adding in some extra animations that they would have never gotten within the time frame that they had. So I think it's just about a rising tide, a tide floats all boats, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true. And I would add that if you're able to afford it or you can convince your, you know, boss or whatever to attend these conferences so you can see how other people do their work. And for me personally, like when Emily and I went to CSS DevConf last year, part of it was almost justifying what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, validation.
Yeah, like, and when I saw that the CBC, that's basically like the BBC of Canada, it's the CBC, they had a presenter there. And when he did his presentation and it looked like an exact clone of what Emily and I did, and I was like, oh, that's a national organization and they're doing something that we're doing. I guess we're doing it correctly.
Well, it's so easy to feel like we operate in vacuums in our own little bubbles, whether we're as independent freelancers or small agencies or even large agencies that maybe don't want to share their quote unquote secrets. You know, you forget that what you may be doing, other people could be doing, but you might learn something new that's more efficient or smarter or more clever or something totally new. It's, I think, the best part about the fact that our industry is ever changing, which means, you know, like our design deliverables have to change to adapt. But that's a good thing. If you really love working in this industry, part of it's because you're always mm-hmm. learning.
Yeah.
Well, this was an awesome talk. And I feel like we can continue talking about this.
Yeah.
And we will, I think, because I'll be seeing you in a couple of weeks yes. for Converge.
Very excited about that.
But before we finish up, we do have our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready?
I think so.
Okay. Question one, Android or iOS?
iOS.
If you were stranded on a desert island and can only bring three things, what would you bring?
Matches. Wait, are we talking like a deserted island, like a beautiful tropical island, like lost, and there might be an airplane on the island somewhere? Or are we talking about like naked and afraid? Because like
naked and afraid.
I'm always like, man, you need a pot to boil water. This always comes up.
You know, the guy who brought duct tape, that was so smart because he made a pot out of it and he also made a shelter
yeah,
out
I mean,
of it.
So, oh, maybe duct tape then. But matches, because I'm always like, you need something to start a fire. You need to be able to boil water, so like a pot probably. And then can I bring a boat?
Sure, that makes sense. I love everyone's answers. Some people are all creature comforts and some people are like really practical.
Well, I think I would have probably been creature comforts until I saw Naked and Afraid for the first time.
I am there with you. My boyfriend and I are addicted to that show.
Speaking of shows, what's your favorite TV show?
Right now, probably House of Cards.
What's your favorite dessert?
Warm chocolate chip cookies.
Mm. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
You know, I think because I feel so strongly about like style towels being kind of like detective work, like finding out what a client likes. So maybe like a detective.
Cool.
What profession would you not like to try?
Man, well, I've tried it before, and that's why I know. I'm the worst waitress ever. I love tipping people because I'm like, oh my gosh, you just did this thing that I would have totally screwed up.
What's the latest article or blog post you've read?
Well, so I read a lot outside of the industry too.
Sure.
Oh, actually, one of my former colleagues, Colleen Bayek, recently wrote a great Medium post about privacy and how you can really up your privacy online. It's fantastic. I recommend you check it out.
Very cool.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
I would probably want to be able to sing like Janis Joplin.
Speaking of that, what music do you like to work to?
Oh, I like to work to all sorts of stuff. I think if I'm designing, I like really bad 90s rock and roll.
Awesome.
All right. Lastly, cats or dogs?
Cats.
Awesome. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
I am at SamanthaToy.com and SamanthaToy on Twitter. And Samantha on Dribbble.
Thanks so much. This was a really good conversation. We had a blast.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
We'd now like to thank our sponsors for this podcast, Visual Chefs and Pixel and Tonic.
And thanks to our partners, Arcus Tech, Devotee, and EE Insider.
We also want to thank our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you liked this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we'll discuss ways to improve diversity in tech with Ash Dryden and Farouk Atesh. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.